All right, so we need to do a little recapping. Last week, King Nebuchadnezzar wakes up from a cold sweat, and he calls all of his advisors together because he's had this dream. All right, and he says, "Tell me my dream. Tell it to me. What is it? What does it mean?" But nobody can do it. So what does he do? He gets mad, and he says, I'm gonna kill you all. I'm just gonna murder you all." Which is when Daniel figures he better get on his knees and pray, because what else are you going to do when a guy like that goes all crazy like that? Daniel says, "Oh God, have mercy on us. Have mercy on us. This king is going to kill us all. Tell us what his dream was. Give us the interpretation so that we can live." And thank goodness God does it. He reveals to Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego the dream and its interpretation. And Daniel takes this to the king, and he says, the king says, "Do you have an answer to my dream, Daniel? Do you have an answer?" And Daniel goes, "No, I don't have an answer except the one that God has given. I have spoken with this God, and he has told me your dream and what it means." That's where we left off last week. We said that what we have here in Daniel 2 is a type of testimony. It's a testimony to the fact that true wisdom comes from only one place, and that place is God. God and God alone is the real source of wisdom. We said that. Even if we look at science, or we look at sociology, and even the kind of reflection discussion that go around our seminar tables at the university or here at church and stuff like this, all of this wisdom that we find in the world is at root the wisdom of God. So when we talk about the good news, we said, the good news of Jesus, when we talk about what this thing we call the gospel, we're talking about something that's given by God to us. And this, we said, includes the answer to human happiness and well-being, our happiness and our well-being, which is nothing less than genuine, real, authentic community, being together. But there's another thing that the wisdom of God teaches us here in Daniel 2. Not only does the wisdom of God promise us happiness in community, it promises us hope for the future. Both happiness in community and hope for the future. Happiness and hope. Because no matter what we say about community and happiness and the beauty of the gospel, the fact of the matter is, when we look around us, when we take a little step back, there's still a lot of ugly out there. Real, genuine community, come to find out, is hard. Happiness isn't really that easy to find. This reminds me of a classic cartoon some of you may remember about Pogo the Possum. Do y'all know Pogo the Possum? All right, some shaking heads. That's better than some of my Sundays. All right, Pogo goes for a walk, all right, one day through the forest with his friend Porcupine. And Porcupine looks up at the trees, and he just goes off in this revelry, and he goes, "Oh, Pogo, the beauty of the forest primeval gets me in the heart." To which Pogo says, "Well, Porcupine, it gets me in the feet." And that's when the camera pulls back and we realize that Pogo and Porcupine are walking over all this trash that's been strewn across the forest floor. And Pogo says, "Yep, son, we have met the enemy, and he is us." Pull back a little bit, and the beautiful forest looks like a trash heap sometimes. So no matter how good things might start to look, and that goodness can be absolutely real. Our happiness can be very true. But no matter how good it might be, we all know that if we just take a step back, there's still a lot of ugly out there in the world. And it's often even in our very own lives. So this is the point. We can't just live knowing that God is the source of all wisdom, and that he wants to be in community with us. This is true, but we've got to know what that wisdom is. We've got to know that God's going to do something about this forest full of trash that we're stepping on, which is why our story in Daniel doesn't stop where we stopped last week. It continues on, and we hear about Nebuchadnezzar's dream, We need some sort of promise, a promise that everything's going to get sorted out, that the forest is going to get cleaned up. And this is what Daniel 2 in the end is about. Daniel walks up to the palace and he says, "Hey, king, don't kill all these people. I have the interpretation for you. You were looking, and lo, there was this great statue. It was huge. Its brilliance, extraordinary. It was standing before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of that statue was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked on, a stone was cut out, not by human hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were all broken into pieces, and they became like chaff. Chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind just carried them away so that not a trace of it can be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." And then Daniel takes a step back, and he tells the king something that would have made probably anybody happy to have heard it, except Nebuchadnezzar knows how the dream ends. Daniel says, You, O King of Kings, you are the head of gold. You're the head of gold. But after you is going to come another, and then another, and then another, until finally there comes this great big stone, cut from the mountain, not by hands. This means that it's not something formed or driven, obviously, by human means, but something formed and driven by God alone. And this God-formed stone, the text says, will crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it will stand forever. So this is the nightmare that Nebuchadnezzar had. His marvelous empire would be followed by another, and then another, and then finally another, and even though that fourth kingdom would be as strong as iron, it would be crushed. It would be obliterated by the stone not made with human hands. No wonder he was scared. He had just been shown his own downfall. He had been told that everything he had ever done would just be crushed, obliterated. Over the years, folks have interpreted this passage, the four kingdoms in Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, as Babylon and Persia, and then the Greece of Alexander the Great, and then finally Rome. A lot of Bibles will actually write these names into them. And so this Bible that I'm using today has them as paragraph headers. And so you're already told the answer. All right? And so you've got, well, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon is the head of gold. That one's obvious. And then the silver torso is the Persian Empire. That's followed by Alexander's bronze six-pack and thighs. Right. All of you thinking that must be an autobiographical photo. Rome, of course, gets this interesting little tidbit about iron mixed with clay, all right, which Daniel says is a sign that it will be a divided kingdom. If you read any Shakespeare, all right, this shouldn't be a surprise to us, all right? The infighting among Roman rulers was pretty much, lore by this time, all right? Julius Caesar et tu Brute, right? We know this. All right, then you got the tragedy of Antony and Cleopatra, all these divisions within Rome. It didn't hurt that there always seemed to be some scandal or salaciousness in these stories either. Shakespeare ate that stuff up. But if you look at the actual text in Daniel, the only kingdom that we have identified is Babylon. All the others, the silver torso, the bronze stomach and thighs, the legs and feet of iron and clay, they're left open. They're not identified. They could be anyone. They could be anything. In the 1930s, folks in Central and Eastern Europe who were reading their Bibles saw in this story Nazi Germany. A couple decades later, the iron legs started to look a lot like an iron curtain that split Berlin in two and went all the way up and down Europe. Depending on which side you were on, Nebuchadnezzar's dream could take on a whole different meaning. And in one way, that's probably how it was meant. It's probably how it should be. The point of the dream isn't who is represented by these different parts of the body. The point of the dream is who's represented by that stone. The stone that comes crashing down from above. The stone not cut by human hands, but shaped and formed and thrown by God. For Nebuchadnezzar, this would have been the nightmare. But for Daniel and his fellow Jews, for the folks living in Poland in the 30s and 40s, for people throughout Europe in the Cold War period, this would have been a miracle. God finally coming in victory, healing all the tyranny, all the ugliness of sin and empire, replacing it with an everlasting kingdom of peace, one that would cover the whole earth. This, they thought, is a dream worth hoping in. It's a promise worth clinging to. It's why the book of Daniel was written and kept and preserved and read over and over and over again, because it gave everyone in exile a promise and a hope. A promise and a hope that would have kept them going throughout the sleepless nights when they too would look out over Pogo the Possum's polluted forest and admit that even though we have met the enemy, God is coming and God's going to make things right. It's the same thing that we hear on Jesus' own lips. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It's the smallest. The smallest of seeds, but when it is grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree even, so that all the birds come and rest in its branches. Jesus gives us hope that one day this seed will blossom into a great tree when all people will be able to come and rest. He promises that God will undo the ugliness and all the confusion in our world right now, so that one day we will have the happiness and the blessed community we talked about last Sunday. This week I drove down to Johnson City, Tennessee, to hear one of my favorite preachers, Tom Long. Watching Tom Long preach, for me, is something like watching a master playwright at work. The man can tell a story, and then he just goes and weaves in another story, and another one, and another one. And I find myself wanting to take notes because they're so good, and yet I get halfway through and he's moved on to another story and I just have to put the thing down and just listen. That's Tom Long. One of the points, though, I did finally manage to get down was this, that we've lost sight today of how important it is to hope like Daniel and his friends, to hope. The reason for this, Tom Long said, the reason for this is simple. He says, we've lost the importance of hoping because we're comfortable. Not because we're uncomfortable, but because we're comfortable. We've got everything we need. Even if there's things we want, we don't approach life really anymore with any sense of hopefulness for what the future has in store. Instead, we start to worry about losing what we already have. Instead of saying, I hope, we start saying, I hope not. I hope not to lose my job. I hope not to get cancer, maybe again. I hope my retirement doesn't run out. I hope my kids don't do something stupid. But this sort of backwards, negative hope isn't really hope at all. It goes by another name, fear. Fear is the opposite of the gospel. It's the opposite of what Jesus is preaching when he said the kingdom of God has come and that it's going to spread over the whole world. You see, the gospel is built not on the fear of what we might lose, but on the hope of what we might gain. No wonder Christians across the centuries have read the story in Daniel and seen Jesus in the stone that's cut without human hands. He's the one sent from God to smash all our fearful and fraught attempts at control. Because guess what? That's what fear is. Fear is our desperate need to be in control. It's our need to have everything subject to our power, to our rule. It's the same thing we find out next 2 weeks from now in chapter 3 with Nebuchadnezzar. But Jesus comes and delivers us from this need, from this fear, from this need to be in control. We don't have to be in control, Jesus says, because God is. That's why we can. That's why he can proclaim peace and mean it. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, he says in John 14. And do not let your hearts be troubled then. Do not let them be afraid. Why not? Because even though I'm going away, he says, I'm going to come back. I'm coming back. The stone that will stand forever is coming. That's the peace of God. That's the hope Daniel preaches to all of us in exile. And we're all in exile. It's the hope that we do not have to worry about taking and keeping control, because God's got that covered. Because the future isn't ours, it's God's. One of the most fascinating things I think we find in Scripture is how important it is to keep reminding ourselves that there's this hope out there. It's why we have the book of Daniel to begin with. It's why Daniel's echoed all throughout the New Testament. Here we are, a people still under Roman oppression and still under the throes of sin that needed hope. These are the people of Daniel. These are the people of the New Testament. They needed God to deliver them. It's why the book of Revelation at the very end of the Bible is through and through a book not about fiery judgment, but about hope. Hope for the future. Hope that God will finally heal this world and make what is wrong in it right. Hope. Every morning, I have to remind myself of this hope. I'm not good at this. I'm the kind of fearful person that Tom Long is talking about. I don't hope, I actually hope not. I hope not to lose what I have. I'm not looking forward, I'm looking back. And I'm looking back in fear. So the question I think this text is asking us today is how many of us are doing the same thing? How many of us don't have hope? How many of us have only fear? How many of us need to return to the hope that is in Jesus Christ, who reminds us that we don't have to be in control? How many of us are worn out from all of this worry every day? If this is you, what I want you to do is just to wake up every morning. I want you to wake up every morning and remember this, that you aren't alone. That the world isn't yours to conquer. That Jesus has already done it. That he's promised that he's going to see it through to the end. This is what we have to do every morning. We have to remember, with Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, that the huge empire is going to be crushed. That it already has been crushed. That our fears are crushed, not by violence, but by compassion, by the cross, by Jesus taking all of that upon himself and upending it. That's the hope. And what the Bible continually tells us throughout it is that despite the fact when we pull back and we see that there's still ugliness in the world, we have hope that it's not the end. That there's a God who is at work cutting out a stone, and he'll take care of it. How many of you want that? How many of you need that? I do. Those are different things, by the way. Amen.